Before I begin, I just want to thank you for having me today. And as I was driving here, I was visiting my niece in San Jose. I was born in Mountain View, and my mom's from Sunnyvale. I think I remember that my grandmother was born and raised in Hayward, though, so it's a bit of a returning to some ancestral home for me, I think. So thank you for having me. Everything we hear is an opinion, not fact. Everything we see is perspective, not truth. These words are from Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius. Everything we hear is opinion, not fact. Everything we see is perspective, not truth. So is the truth merely a subjective observation? The story of the blind man and the elephant might indicate that this is one way of understanding truth. They couldn't understand the whole elephant from where they stood. Their context was limited to their own experience, their own reality of what they could feel and touch. Truth is what we experience. So this is one way of understanding truth. But we cannot experience everything, and we don't live in a vacuum. We live in relationships with others who have their own experiences, and they share their experience with us, and sometimes we find that it resonates with our own experiences. And so the truth becomes something that is a shared experience. Truth then is personal, and it's also relational. But what else is truth? Well, I'm going to defer to the ultimate source of truth, Google search. Never seems to fail. Okay, Google, what is truth? Truth is the state of being true, that which is true or in accordance with fact or reality, a fact or belief that is accepted as true. So then it's just something we all agree on, maybe. If truth is a quality or state of being, an accepted belief in accordance with facts and reality, then truth is indeed relative, because our knowledge of facts, reality, and the nature of our own being are ever changing. Truth then is not an unchanging thing or fact, but truth is a process of meaning making. Of course, it's a process of deep meaning making. For the truths we hold go right to our very core, and they nourish our systems of faith and belief. It is in our truths, elusive and changing as they may be, that we find ourselves grounded. Now, the fourth principle of our UU faith states that we affirm and promote the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Interestingly enough, the words free and truth have been reversed here from how they read in the Gospel of John, which says that the truth shall set you free. So is it truth that leads to freedom, or is it freedom that leads to truth? I suppose the answer is yes. I like to play it safe. For we must be able to be free in seeking truth if we ever hope to find it, and yet it leads to a kind of freedom that before we may not have known, because it beckons us into a deeper state of knowing. Again, that's what grounds us. Truth grounds us while at the same time pulling our roots further into the dark mystery that lies beneath. So we're called to find what lies beyond. Now, our fourth principle, again, it promotes this free and responsible search for truth and meaning in our lives, which I'm just going to say, we sometimes avoid that. I think as you use, sometimes we're really good at saying what we don't believe. And, well, I know it's not this. And I know it's not that. But sometimes we don't often take the time to really delve in to find what our own truths are, like our statements about the big questions in life. Because this is what this is really calling us into. Questions like, what is life's purpose? What is the nature of the divine, or is there a divine? What is our nature? Why do bad things happen? What happens after we die? Those are the questions. That's the truth that it's inviting us to. Now, have you leaned into these questions? Maybe. Or have you stated more what you knew wasn't true? Maybe. Have you found your truths to life's deepest mysteries? I think it's a bit daunting. I mean, who am I to propose an answer to life's deepest questions? Certainly, there must be somebody more qualified than me, a scientist, a wise sage somewhere who knows the answers, who knows these truths. But that's just the thing. Our faith tells us that there's no better qualified person to answer these questions for you than you. You are the one who holds on to your own truths. This isn't to say that these truths can't be influenced by a scientist or a wise sage somewhere. But ultimately, your truths belong to you. You're responsible for making meaning of your own life. When I tackled these questions in a constructive theology class in seminary, it wasn't an invitation, it was a requirement. And I felt overwhelmed. We had to write a big paper about these big questions. And I hadn't exactly named what my deepest truths were. Perhaps I was afraid. I mean, what if my truths were wrong? I mean, if truth is relative, that means that a truth can be wrong. And history is chock full of wrongful truths. Heck, I think the present is chock full of wrongful truths. They're all around us. Wrongful truth, it kind of seems like an oxymoron, and yet they're everywhere. I guess that's because the truth is always changing. It was once true that the world was flat, but it didn't stay flat. And that was replaced by a model that said that it was the sun that revolved around us. And that didn't stay true. So now we believe that we're hurtling through space in some kind of vortex spiral thing. I don't know if you've seen those graphics. They're pretty amazing. And yet I think someday that might not be true either. Maybe it's true for now, because the truth about truth is that it's a lot like science. It's a working model. Truth is our best guess given what we know at this moment. It's subjective and it's relative. We change and it changes. Perhaps our best consolation then when we're diving into big truths and meaning-making questions is that it does change. And so it doesn't feel like it has to be the truth forever. It just has to be our truth for right now. That gave me comfort when I tackled that constructive theology paper. Our instructor, he encouraged us to use a metaphor to find our truths, maybe using something that was familiar to us, you know, preach what you know. All right. So before I went to seminary, I was a chef for 25 years. So if I'm going to go seeking for truth and meaning in the place that's most familiar to me, the place where I'm going to find all of life's deepest questions, it'll have to be in a recipe. So that's where I went. So here's my truth. Bread starts with water. Now, this is fitting because so does all of life. I think I'm off to a good start. I mean, life doesn't exist without water. So I call the water in my recipe the spirit of life. And the purpose of water is not just to give bread life, but it also gives it fluidity so it can grow and move as it needs to later and become greater than the parts that it's made up of. So our recipe begins then with everything that can be held within the promise of life. We start with water. Now to this I add yeast. Yeast is a living organism that doesn't grow unless it's exposed to an organic compound. So I think that yeast represents faith in our recipe. Faith, it's faith that guides us, but only when it's in relationship with something else. Something has to enact our faith. Faith alone is dormant, like yeast sitting in a jar in the cabinet. It doesn't do anything. It must be engaged through relationship. But added to the water, the yeast comes alive, and the slurry begins to bubble, and the yeast is happy in the water, and it wants to grow even more, and it cries out for more. This is why next I add just a touch of honey. And I do this because yeast loves sugar. It loves it. It gobbles it up, and it converts the carbohydrates into carbon monoxide, and then it rises, you know, and you get this big foamy kind of thing going on. So this is what's going to give our bread rise. The yeast, but now the yeast is especially active because I've added a touch of sugar. But I'm wondering, what is it that feeds our faith that causes it to grow more abundantly? What would I call this sweetness? And I think what feeds our faith the most is love. It's love that feeds faith. I have an asterisk here in the recipe. Recipe note. Not all bread has sweetness to it. Love is not required for faith to grow. Faith may also be fed by fear, by loneliness, by anger, by all sorts of other things. In this recipe, I've chosen to add sweetness. I've chosen to add love. But it should be noted that love is always a choice. Now, the sweetness of love might be a choice to add, but the next ingredient is required, and that's salt. What does salt do to the mix? What does it add? What does it detract? What's its purpose? Well, salt is a balancer for the yeast. It keeps it from growing beyond its sustainability, maybe becoming self-righteous. Salt will help the flour that we're going to add in a little bit to gain strength and support the bread as it continues to grow. Salt also adds flavor and depth. If you don't have salt in the bread, it tastes flat and it's lacking. But if you use too much salt, everything is ruined. So salt is suffering. It must be there for the recipe to be complete. It must interact with the other ingredients. A small amount, that is the suffering that is natural in life, illness, death, earthquakes, that's enough. We don't need to add more salt to the recipe with violence and all of the isms and greed that ruins the loaf. But a small amount will enhance and strengthen the loaf. Too much and we taint the whole thing. So salt is suffering. Now at this point our mix is bubbly and it's ready to move. But in order for it to move, it needs something to hang on to give it structure. So we add the flour. Now that's community. That's us. That's you and that's me. We're the grains of the earth. We are the structure. Each one of us a little bit of grain. The bread we are making can only know and be known in this context of the community. So we are the flour. Next, we knead the dough. Now, kneading is a big, important. I don't know how many bread makers there are here, but you have to knead the dough. You actually have to put your intention and your action into it, or else it's not going to grow, right? You'll just have a big, spongy glob. So we have to add our own action. We have to push, we have to pull, we have to take the time and put our intention into this loaf because that's what's going to strengthen the gluten that's in the bread and flour that's us, right? It's going to strengthen the community so that it can sustain the growth. We have to, like, get those gluten strong. So we do that by pushing and pulling it. And then we set the dough aside and we walk away. We set it in a nice quiet spot. Because we need rest, right? We have to be patient sometimes when we're letting things grow. So we set it aside and we walk away. And we come back in an hour or so. And I don't know if there are any bread makers here, but who knows what the next step is? You punch it down. Now the bread has grown and it's gained strength, but there's still more room for development, so we've got a little setback here because that's life. And so we wait for it to rise again, and finally it's right. So with gentle hands, we shape our bread to what we need. And we place it in the heat, in the fire, and this faith, this love, this suffering, our intention, the community, our tenderness, the space that we gave it, it's all returned back to the fire, back to that cosmic heat that we all came from. And there, it dies. So I'm writing this recipe. I'm like, well, there it dies. Wait, it just dies. Like, that's not a really good ending for my recipe of truths. It's really dismal. Does it all just end with death? Is that the final verdict of my truths? So I take the bread into my hands, and it's a coffin holding the life that it once was. And I tear it open. I tear it open and I bring a piece of it toward me, and the holes of the bread hold all the memory of all of that suffering, of all of that love, of all of that intention, of the patience, of the life, of the potential. It's all there. Somebody said once, the flavor of the bread is in the holes. That's profound. But it's true. The holes make space for something, and they have to be there. Otherwise, we just have a dense, unedible brick. So we needed these holes. We needed this growth, and they hold on to everything. But still, I hold it, this death, and I wonder if that's the end of the story. And I take a little bit of it, and I eat it. And it's pretty good. And as I'm chewing it, I think, this is death. But I'm only alive because I'm eating it. So then, it's death that feeds life. Always. And life that feeds death, and death that feeds life, and so on and so on. Eternal life? I wasn't expecting to find that. But now I have something to chew on. Blessed be and bon appetit.